This is the first of the Where Did the Road Go midweek podcasts, and hopefully we'll be doing these on a semi-regular basis. There's no set schedule for these, but so as we get them, we'll put them up. And tonight, starting this off, is Mr. Paul Kimball, who does a blog called The Other Side of Truth, has a book out by the same title, is a film producer, and, well, multi-talented in many, many respects. How you doing, Paul?
I'm good. How are you, Soraya?
I'm good. So I wanted to have you on. I thoroughly enjoyed your podcast. We had you back on talking about your book months ago.
Yes, thank you for having me on back then, too. I enjoyed the conversation.
And you seem to have a wide base of knowledge, let's say. You know, you study a lot of different things. You go all over the place, from movies, music, to the paranormal, to what did you go to school for?
I have an honors degree in history and political science, and I have a law degree where I specialized as much as you can within the law in family law, criminal law, and legal history of all things. So, and I'm an old political, well, not that old, but I spent many years working behind the scenes in politics and here in Canada and other things. So, yeah, you know, I think we should all have a broad, I mean, we do all have a broad range of interests, don't we? We're not all, that's the thing.
True.
When people talk about the paranormal, which is a very broad subject anyway, sometimes people look at them and go, oh, you're just the paranormal guy, right? I actually have been tagged as, you're the UFO filmmaker. And no, I made films about UFOs, but I made a lot of films about other things too. And so we all human beings should have a broad range of interests. So I'm no different than anyone else, I guess.
True, but you bring it out more, I think. You talk about it more because you have the podcast. So I'm more familiar with the stuff you are familiar with.
Fair enough. And I'm also a shameless self-promoter. So it's, you know, that's the one thing that I have over 99% of the population.
And one of the things I found interesting, and people can check out your podcast. You have two seasons worth up, and that is available on your website?
Yes, it's on my company's website, redstarfilmtv.com. You just go to the radio section, two seasons of podcasts. The first season is actually, there's a couple of original shows I did, but I also went back into the tapes of various interviews I've done for film and television over the years with people like the late Carl Flock, Stan Friedman, Kevin Randall, and I pulled excerpts of those out and turned them into a podcast. This season, season two, they're all new interviews. So everyone from Dean Radin and Kevin Randall, again, talking about Roswell, to Micah Hanks and Greg Bishop. It's sort of a very diverse, eclectic range of people, and it's not, actually it is kind of all to do with the paranormal in some sense or another, but I'd like to talk to people about politics and stuff like that too, which maybe we can talk about a bit.
Yes, well, one of the things you had mentioned a few times on there and was 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something I've never talked to anyone about on the air, and I figured you would be a good person to sort of semi-debate this. You seem, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you feel that the official story is probably true.
Actually, I feel that the official story, and if by official story you mean that 19 terrorists hijacked planes and flew them into buildings, blowing them up and causing everything that came out of that, if that's what you mean by the official story.
That's what I mean by the official story.
Then absolutely, because the official story could also be taken to be the 9/11 report issued by the American government. And I think there are flaws in there, but I think those are flaws that you could expect in a report that was issued in a relatively short time after the incident. And I'm saying relatively short in the grand historical scheme of things, because a decade is nothing in the global universal bucket of time. So it can take a long time. We're still wondering, trying to figure out what happened in the First World War in some instances, or what really went on in the Second World War or throughout history. So it can take a while to really get all of the details for a whole bunch of reasons. But the one thing that I am sure of is that the central narrative, which is that the terrorists are the ones responsible for the destruction of the World Trade Centers and at the Pentagon, is absolutely 100% correct. Because the alternative story that has been put out there is that there was a government conspiracy, that the American government was responsible for that. And there's many different, talk to 10 different conspiracy theorists about 9/11. And the one thing they could all agree on is that the American government was responsible in some way, but then all 10 of them would give you different narratives of how that happened, you know, like explosives were placed in the World Trade Centers, or a missile was fired at the Pentagon, or a certain flight net was forced down and then the passengers were all machine gunned, whatever. And, you know, that's just there's absolutely, in my mind, there's no evidence for that narrative. In fact, all the evidence overwhelmingly, conclusively points to exactly what the so-called official narrative is, that it was terrorists. And I don't know where you want to go with this, but my concluding sort of comment would be, I do think there was a conspiracy. So there, it seems like I'm contradicting myself. But the two things that I do, well, no, I don't agree with the so-called truthers on. But in fact, what I would say is the truthers are not only missing the point and making a mistake, they're wrong, but they're undermining the cause of those of us who would point to the real crimes that were committed by the American government and by the British government too, and by other governments. And those were crimes that took place after 9/11, when the American government and the British government and other members of the so-called Coalition of the Willing or Coalition of the Coerced launched an illegal war against Iraq without the sanction of the United Nations, a war of aggression. And whether you like Saddam Hussein or not, and I didn't, and I'm, you know, the world is better off for not having him around. So no tears shed over Saddam Hussein. But there is such a thing called international law. We're supposed to abide by it. It was a system set up by the United States largely after the Second World War, the United Nations, the Security Council, all of that. If you don't abide by that, then you are a lawless regime. And what the United States government, what the Bush government did, was faced with this terrible tragedy, this terrorist attack on 9/11, it took the opportunity and said, you know, here's something we've kind of been cooking in our heads for a while, which is we really should try and get Iraq. For whatever, and you, people can debate about what the reasons were, and there were many conflicting interests. Some of them were economic, some of them were political, some of them were a combination of the two. But we want to, for whatever reason, get rid of Saddam Hussein, start a war in Iraq. This is the perfect excuse. So what we're going to do is we're going to use this, which is really terrible, to take an attack and a tragedy like that and use it to launch a war that has resulted in hundreds of thousands of deaths, instability in the entire Middle East, and we're seeing it now play out across the Middle East in Syria and other places, and created this entire mess. That's the real crime. And so when people focus on this idea that the United States government conducted a conspiracy to blow up the World Trade Centers and the Pentagon as some kind of false flag operation, that's, to me, that's ridiculous, and it's totally missing the point, and it undermines, and it really takes attention away from the real story, which is, if you want to be mad at the American government, you have every right to, but you should be mad at what they did after 9/11 and how they used 9/11 to launch an illegal war in conjunction with Tony Blair and the British government and some other governments. So that's my take in a nutshell on 9/11.
I actually totally agree with the part about the Iraq war. My stance on the whole thing is I honestly don't know what to believe. Because conspiracy theories go anywhere from completely bonkers to somewhat believable, depending on who you're listening to. And as you said, there's no one set conspiracy theory. There are things that happened that day, however, that don't make sense to me as far as the official story goes. And what I wanted to do is kind of throw them to you and have you give me your take on them.
Sure. Assuming, I'm happy to give my take on anything, assuming that I have a knowledge base that allows me to comment in an informed fashion. So go ahead. Sure. Yeah, sure.
Sure. Okay. One of the big ones that everyone always throws out is Building 7 and the way it came down. What are your thoughts on Building 7 in general?
Oh, good. I'm glad you started on that one because that one's easy. Building 7 collapsed because of damage, structural damage that was caused by debris falling off and eventually the debris of the two main World Trade Center towers. And what people often miss about WT7 is, or WTC7, is that they see photos, they see pictures, they see film footage of one side of the building. And sure, windows are blown out and you can see some fires and some smoke, but generally speaking, you would look at it and you go, well, it doesn't actually seem that bad. I mean, it seems bad, but it doesn't seem bad, like the kind of bad that would cause a building to collapse. If you look at the other side of the building, which is the footage that the truthers don't want you to see, you will see a building that is severely damaged. If you can talk to...
It looks almost gutted on the other side.
Yeah, and that's damage that came from debris coming from the World Trade Centers when they collapsed. And so that's the damage that eventually caused the collapse later in the day of World Trade Center 7. It's a very, very simple answer. There are actually more interesting and complicated, and I still think solvable or answerable questions about 9/11, but that's the best one. That's the one I like the best, because if you always hear the World Trade Center, the truthers come out and they talk about that one, I go, great, thank you for bringing that one up, because that one's easy. That one, I don't know how you can not understand how that building came down. And yet, here's the thing. When you talk to them, you can't even get past that one, because Nick Pope, you know Nick Pope, the British yes. UFO researcher, used to work for the Ministry of Defense. We were at I love telling this story. We were at the X conference in Washington in 2007. Both of us were, he was speaking, I was showing one of my films. And after one of the days, he and I went down to the hotel bar and we were having a couple of drinks. And we were approached by this group, I think it was about four or five younger people, who were, it turned out they were all 9/11 truthers. They were conspiracy theorists or whatever. And they wanted to ask us, I think because Nick had said something during his lecture maybe about 9/11, just a passing remark, I don't know. But anyway, they wanted to ask us what we thought. Mostly they wanted to ask him, because they didn't know me so much, wanted to ask him what he thought about 9/11. So he told them, and he agrees, he and I are in complete agreement. So they're sitting there incredulous as he's telling them, oh, there's no conspiracy. Well, there is. There's a conspiracy of 19 Arab terrorists and blah, 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 all that sort of thing. And then they start talking and talking and talking and pointing, and they bring up World Trade Center building number 7. And that's when I chimed in and I gave the answer I just gave. And Nick's nodding his head too, going, yes, yeah, you absolutely, of course. And they wouldn't let it go. They just said, well, no, this isn't true. You don't know what you're talking about. And it was at that point that I said, well, and they had all but so been going on about the 9/11 Commission report, how it was nothing but a series of lies and cover-ups. And I said, have you ever read, and this is the truther movement in a nutshell to me, I said, have you ever read the 9/11 Commission report? Because I have. Nick, have you read it? Yes, cover to cover. Right, so we've read it. Have you ever read it? None of them had. They all went out of their way to say, no, we've never read it. Why would we? We know it's a whitewash. And at that point, Nick and I just kind of politely said, look, we'll buy you a round and this conversation on this subject is over, because we can't talk to you. You don't know what you're talking about because you haven't even read the official response in detail. And it's a pretty long report. I mean, like it's a book. Right. You haven't read that. So how can you talk intelligently about it? And then how dare you at the same time say that we are not talking intelligently about the World Trade Center 7, which is all we were talking about at that time. So that's the 9/11 truther movement to me in a nutshell. Because if you see the films they put out, if you see the lectures they give, they focus and they misconstrue evidence in a way that they accuse the government of doing. They doctor stuff, they shade things. It's a very clever propaganda sort of style kind of operation. And I think it's largely because they are just programmed to distrust government, to even hate their government. And a healthy distrust of a government is not necessarily a bad thing. But when it overrides your critical faculties on something like the World Trade Center building number 7, then I don't know what to tell you. And, you know, one of the other things that you often hear people talk about, I've actually heard people say that planes did not crash into the buildings, to which I would say, well, what was it then? Some massive global holodeck program that was running? Because I sat in front of a television. I didn't see the first one live, but I saw the second one live and replayed ever since. I don't know. How do you explain that? Well, it's all part of the plot. Great. How is it part of the plot? How did they pull that off? And they never have an answer for that. They just keep repeating the line. So yeah. So that's why I don't generally, whenever I hear people say they're a 9/11 truther, I just politely bow out of the conversation, because I've learned there's nothing to come of it. And they are people, I have to tell you, I honestly believe that if the government is involved as they used to be in COINTELPRO stuff and, you know, infiltrating the counterculture movements in the 1960s and all that sort of stuff, which the government clearly did, and they're probably still doing it with the Occupy Wall Street movement and everything, then I would suspect that one of the ways they would infiltrate, it'd be perfect. If I was there and I wanted to cover up my war crimes and my illegal war against Iraq, I'd say, look, we have to distract people from the real story, which is we made billions of dollars on this war that was launched illegally and a lot of people are dead. We got to come up with something really crazy, but it'll be just anti-government enough that a lot of people might believe it. Great, let's come up with the 9/11 truth movement. Let's distract everybody by, and so it wouldn't surprise me if some of these guys, these engineers and stuff, who are the leaders of the 9/11 truth movement, are actually on the payroll of the government, because it sounds, everything they say sounds like some sort of counterintelligence kind of false flag. They sound like the false flag, and the false flag is to distract us from the real story, which is what happened after 9/11, and which was a very rambling answer about your World Trade Center 7 question. Sorry about that.
See, the thing is, when I look at it, and I've seen those pictures of it gutted on the other side, I know that there was a lot of damage to that building. It's the way it fell, though, that comes up as suspicious. Even knowing that damage is there, it seems like it would have kind of caved in towards that damage, not free fall straight down.
Well, everybody says free fall. Free fall is one of the favorite words. You hear free fall used in talking about the main World Trade Center buildings, too.
But those weren't free falls.
No, and I don't think the World Trade Center 7 building was a free fall either. It was a collapse of a building. I don't think, now I might be wrong, so I won't speak for you, but I will speak for me. Of all the things at the beginning of our little chat, you said Paul knows a lot of stuff about a lot of things, and it's true, I do, but I'm not an engineer. So I don't know jack, really, about collapsing buildings. I don't blow them up for a living. I didn't study engineering. I honestly don't know. Now I can look at video the same as the next guy. But you know what that's worth? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Because that would be like saying to you, and I'm kind of guessing you don't have a degree in brain surgery, but if you do, I apologize. But that would be like saying, you know, it's kind of like in The Simpsons where Dr. Nick, he's this sort of, you know, I'm Dr. Nick. And he operates on Homer in one episode because it's all that Homer can afford. I think it's open heart surgery. And so, okay, Dr. Nick's a general practitioner, but he's never done open heart surgery before. And long story short, what Lisa Simpson has to do is kind of yell at him from the window, you know, where you can watch the operation, going, you have to cut there. Like, this little girl knows more about operating than he does. And he's going, the hip bone's connected to the something, and the something's connected to the some. And that's what people are like who claim that they know how buildings would fall and all that sort of stuff, unless they're actually engineers or people that are trained in doing that. So I ignore anyone who doesn't have that kind of training. Then I say, well, okay, who does? Great, give me those people. And the vast majority, overwhelming majority of people that do have that kind of training and do those things for a living, look at it and say, yes, the building fell the way buildings should fall. And all buildings fall in slightly different ways, depending on the damage and everything. And then they can go through a very long analysis of the structural damage and how it would have led for it to collapse in that particular way. And I go, you know what? One of two things is possible. Either you believe that all of these people are being paid by the government, and I know the truthers believe that, so there's no talking to them, or you accept the word of the professionals when they have an overwhelming consensus. It's kind of like the global warming thing. You know, when an overwhelming amount of scientists, and not just climate scientists, tell you that global warming, human-caused global warming, is real and a problem, then you kind of should accept what they're telling you until somebody can bring conclusive evidence otherwise, which doesn't exist with WTC7.
Well, I think there are a great number of engineers that do disagree with that who don't have a problem with the way that the main towers came down, just Building 7.
If there is a great number of engineers, I haven't heard from them. And I've watched most of the films. You see one or two, and they're usually the same ones that are trotted out. But I don't know where the overwhelming consensus in the engineering, civil engineering community is that says that WTC-7 was a controlled demolition, because that's what we're talking about.
That is what we're talking about. And that's the only other way that it would have come down.
Right. And so at that point, and it's kind of like a backdoor way for the truthers to get into the entire conspiracy thing, because here's what they're confronted with. So we've got the two main World Trade Center towers, right? And we have clear evidence that the airplanes flew into those things, blew them up, large fires. Now, people can argue at that point, and they do, and they say, well, and, you know, there was still a controlled demolition, that was kind of a sort of a thing that they put out there to distract from the fact that they wired these giant buildings with explosives. And ask somebody how hard it is to wire a building and not be noticed that you're doing it and bring it down. Fine. And they had to do it with two of them. Okay. But that's hard. They look at that, and I think they finally realize, wow, you know, most people aren't buying that. So here's what we'll do. We'll get a backdoor in. We'll go to World Trade Center 7, which seems like an absolutely logical thing to me. But we'll try and convince people that that was a controlled demolition, because that's what it has to be if it isn't just naturally, you know, debris that caused it to collapse. And then if we can, then we'll say, well, that was a controlled demolition. Well, of course, now that you've bought that, the other ones had to be controlled demolitions too, right? So why would you have World Trade Center 7 be a controlled demolition and the other two, the main towers, not? And so they kind of, I think, got around to World Trade Center 7 as an afterthought and used it as, we're gonna walk in the back door on the entire conspiracy thing, because the earlier conspiracy stuff that we were coming up with, you know, robot control planes or whatever it is that, that they would be talking about,
right,
or controlled demolition of the main towers, wasn't flying. So, okay, well, we've got what seems to be, to us, an anomaly over here. That, and you run into the same problem with that building, which is, if you believe the controlled demolition story, which is, well, okay, how did they do that? How did you cover that up? How many people would have known about it? The answer is a lot. How did that activity not get noticed? And how could you possibly believe, in order to, it boggles the mind. And you would have to have had that building damaged, because if the building hadn't been damaged, if it hadn't been significantly damaged, here's the things you're relying on. The World Trade Centers are going to collapse so that you can claim that there's significant damage to the building, so that you can claim that if you're running the conspiracy, so that you could claim that that building collapsed naturally. Nobody would do that because there's just too much risk. So what if the World Trade Center buildings don't collapse? Well, okay, how do we blow up World Trade Center 7 then and make it seem plausible? Because there's no damage to the building, or very little, falling off the still standing World Trade Centers. So you kind of have to, at that point, the conspiracy becomes so complicated, and you realize if you look at conspiracies, and they do exist throughout human history, the ones that actually are successful are relatively small and relatively self-contained, don't require a lot of people, and don't get overcomplicated. You, in the film industry here, there's a very successful producer in Halifax named Michael Donovan, who runs Salter Street Films, which is now DHX Entertainment, very big company. And he has a principle. I remember hearing him say this when I worked for Salter 15 years ago. It's the KISS principle, and it applies to conspiracies as well as running a business. And the KISS principle, K-I-S-S, is not about the rock band. It is keep it simple, stupid. And there's a comma between simple and stupid. So keep it simple, stupid. That's the principle for basically doing anything. It applies to asking girls out on a date. Keep it simple, stupid. Just ask her out on the date. You know, you don't have to read her Byron-esque poetry or something. Just, you know, ask her out. So when you get to the 9/11 conspiracy, so-called conspiracy, the keep it simple, stupid principle applies to the terrorists. Yeah, keep it simple. Learn how to fly planes. Rely, and it, you know, they're courageous, and people hate it when you say courageous about the terrorists, but they were. They took a huge risk. And to say otherwise, I think, diminishes the entire incident. There was a reliance on a failure of the intelligence system, which happened, but I don't even think they would have thought about that. They just took a risk, like most terrorists do. And you can see that throughout human history too, whether it's the IRA planting bombs, they don't always work. A lot of terrorist plots foil themselves or don't get pulled off, or they back out, or they just fail. But in this case, the terrorists got it right. So that's the conspiracy, and they kept it simple. The alternative is to believe that the government cooked up this giant conspiracy that is anything but simple, that relies on so many moving parts that it would be, that somehow, and it still remains undiscovered. So the mind-boggling thing is that you have these people who sort of believe that the government is infallible, literally infallible, because they pulled off this kind of conspiracy with all these moving parts that would have involved hundreds or thousands of people knowing about it, being involved and participating in it. And 10 years, 11 years now later, it still remains completely, like, the vast majority of people accept the so-called official narrative. And it's kind of like Roswell, because when people talk about Roswell, you hear people say, well, let's talk about the Ramey memo, or let's talk about this witness or that witness or what they say. And I say, let's step back and let's just examine the idea of alien spacecraft crashing in the desert of New Mexico in 1947 after flying all the way here from another planet. So they're highly advanced technology, and our 1947 era radar is capable of bringing them down. Then when they do crash, let's assume even if they did crash, the aliens left their ships there for us to find them. Even though the reason that the UFO people will tell you the aliens would be in New Mexico in 1947 was to monitor nuclear weapons testing, our advanced radar, and our rockets. See, I've listened to Uncle Stan Friedman, who, those are the things. He always points out those three things were going on in New Mexico. So that's why they were there. Wait, so they were there to monitor that because they were afraid that we were going to be going in space soon and we're an incredibly warlike race. But when they crashed their advanced technology spacecraft against all odds in New Mexico, they just leave it there for us to find, and because we're clever monkeys, potentially reverse engineer the technology that would allow us to leap far ahead of ourselves to their level of technology and go conquer the galaxy. And then my head starts to spin. I go, none of that makes sense. I don't need to talk about the Raimi memo or Glenn Dennis and his alien bodies because the basic story doesn't make sense. It's this Occam's razor. There's a simpler answer. The same thing is true with 9/11. The conspiracy is so complicated, and you can talk about all these different things, but I go, none of that makes sense because it's just this giant octopus with all these tentacles, with all these people on these tentacles. And keep it simple, stupid. The real story, the one that makes sense, is actually the one that really happened, which is that 19 Arab terrorists got lucky, you know, showed some ingenuity, and we should give them credit for that. Showed some courage, and we should give them some credit for that too. And got lucky. It happens. It's happened throughout human history, and it's going to happen again. So that's kind of my overarching answer in a very long-winded way, again, Soraya, to all questions about 9/11. I just keep coming back, you know, to the basic central. There's two competing alternative stories here. And if you're going to start talking about a conspiracy on 9/11, then you're going to get dragged down into that octopus of all of this stuff. And at the end of the day, it just doesn't make any sense.
Well, first of all, I greatly enjoyed your interview with Kevin Randall about Roswell and how you kind of took it apart on him. Because although he still believes that something crashed, you know, a UFO crashed there, you did a very good job of pointing out how little evidence there is to support that. And second, the thing I was talking about was the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, where they have 2,030 architects and engineers who have signed on for an investigation into the collapse of the World Trade Center 7.
First of all, that's still not a very large number. It seems like a large number, but as a percentage of overall architects and engineers, I have a sneaking suspicion that that is a pretty small percentage in the United States of practicing architects and engineers.
Right,
secondly,
but it doesn't necessarily mean they're wrong either.
It does. First of all, they're calling for a further investigation.
Yes.
I would be interested in knowing when they actually made that call, because the final report on World Trade 7, Center 7, was issued quite a while after the original 9/11 Commission report, which one of the complaints. And World Trade Center 7 was not a focus of the original 9/11 Commission. They were focusing in primarily on the general narrative and on the World Trade Centers. WTC-7 was issued almost as a supplementary report, as I recall. So some of these people have probably had their questions. In fact, I think most of them have probably had their questions answered by now, whatever questions they had. The other thing I would say is you just can't view it in isolation. So you can't say on the one hand that I think, you know, planes really did bring down the World Trade Center, the main ones, but then somehow this thing was pre-wired to explode as if we knew it was coming. So now you're into the conspiracy thing, and once you're in, you have to go full bore, and then you run into all the problems with all the other stuff. But that's the problem with the truthers. They want you to look at everything in isolation, and then they construct, you know, a very sort of seemingly compelling, to them at least, narrative about any individual thing. But it's like a puzzle, and the problem is when you put all those puzzle pieces together, they don't fit. You, instead of getting the picture of the Matterhorn, you get something that looks like a Salvador Dali painting. And whereas if you look at the so-called official narrative, the puzzle does fit. When you put the pieces together, you actually wind up with the Matterhorn or whatever your picture of the puzzle is. So I would be very interested to know how many of those people who signed that or are involved in that actually still believe that, or actually still think that WTC-7 is a mystery somehow, because I suspect the number now is a lot less, because that official answer, and I could Google it now, was issued a couple of years ago, I think, the sort of explanation that I'm talking about. And I suspect that those people signed on to that before that, and they would have had a valid concern in the sense that, you know, yeah, we'd like all of the questions answered. So you haven't dealt with WTC7 yet, so we'd like you to deal with that. Well, okay, now we've dealt with it. So now how many civil engineers and architects are willing to sign something saying, we think that explanation is wrong. We believe that it had to be a controlled demolition, because that's what I want them to say. I don't want them to say, we think it might be something else. I want them to say in writing, we think it was a controlled demolition, part of a conspiracy orchestrated by the American government to kill thousands of Americans and then lead us into wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and wherever else. That's what I want them to say, because that is where it all leads. That is the end game of the conspiracy theorists. And so I would just wish that they would be honest and say, not that we have concerns, just say you don't accept the official explanation when one is available, and here's what we think happened. Because really, you only have one other choice if you don't accept the official explanation.
Well, I don't think that's necessarily true, because I don't accept the official explanation, but I'm not a conspiracy theorist either. I simply don't know. Things don't sit right with me, I think, is the thing. But
what's the other choice then? Well, what do you think it is? Because, okay, you don't accept that it fell naturally, that it was debris falling off the World Trade Center towers that caused it to collapse on its own, naturally, with no human...
Well, it could also be foreknowledge. It doesn't mean that they had to conspire to cause it or anything like that. They may have known something was happening, and we're going to bring that building down regardless.
Who was going to bring it down?
Whoever brought it down. Probably the owner, I would think.
So
who is the guy who came out and said that they pulled the building?
Well, no, they didn't say they... That's another one. They didn't say they pulled the building. That's one of the most egregious misrepresentations out of the truther camp. They were pulling the fire crews out of the building.
Well, that was his explanation afterwards, but if you listen to the actual clip, he says he decided to pull it.
Which
is... It didn't say anything about firemen, and it doesn't make sense in relation to firemen at that point.
It absolutely does. It absolutely makes sense to me. I have listened to the clip, and what they're talking about is pulling the fire crews and the emergency responders out of the building because it was becoming too dangerous to work in there, and because they were worried that the building was going to collapse. That is the explanation that, yeah, it came out afterwards because nobody was asking them at the time. So, of course, you would say, yes, that's the explanation they came up with afterwards, because that's when people asked them. At the time, they had better things to do, like sort of deal with the mess that was going on. But this idea that this meant that they were going to, quote, quote, pull the building, that, I mean, at that point, I just, you know, I respectfully kind of have to bow out of the conversation because it's not a conversation for me anymore. Because and it's not directed at you, but it's you can't pick and choose and you can't cherry pick pieces of this so-called conspiracy. You can't say there wasn't a conspiracy here, that the Arab terrorists really did this. But then World Trade Center, somehow the owner of the building knew, pre-wired, that this was going to happen on this day, pre-wired his building so that he could blow it up and take advantage of that, hoping that there would be enough damage coming from the collapsing World Trade Centers that they were going to collapse that was going to make it look like his building. And I mean, your head starts to spin, or at least mine does at that point.
I have found that the more you look into this, the more your head starts to spin in every direction, honestly. There's especially if you start looking at conspiracies, because there's some of them go so far out there and are based on nothing more than assumptions. But like I said, I'm not standing up for the conspiracies. I'm just asking the questions. One of the other things that always bought, well, you know what? Let's do this. Why do you think it is that the government's never released footage of the plane hitting the Pentagon?
Don't know.
Because that one's always bugged me. It seems like that would be a simple solution to the whole, was it a plane, was it a missile?
Honestly, can't answer it because I don't know. I'm not the government. I honestly don't know. Could be any one of a number of things. That's not a big problem for me. I mean, it just isn't. These are the Raimi memo things. I don't get dragged down into these outstanding questions, because there's outstanding questions about a whole bunch of things throughout human history.
Oh, sure.
What matters to me is, does the big picture narrative make sense? What is the answer? And then, you know, the sort of individual outstanding questions eventually will be answered in time, or in some cases they're never answered. But that's not a question that I can answer because I'm not the government. I don't like speculating about why or why not individuals or people might do something or not do something. And I don't have a problem because the question I would then answer in return is, okay, well, where's the plane? If it didn't hit the world, if it didn't hit the Pentagon and explode, where is the plane?
That is a very good question.
Well, that's the one before I want to engage with, before anyone gets to ask me the question, and I don't mean you, I don't want to sound confrontational with you, but before these truthers get to ask anyone the question, well, why won't they release the footage? I'd say, fine, you tell me where the plane is with all those people on it. When you can tell me where that plane is, other than crashing into the Pentagon, then maybe we have a question, but they can't.
You also got to consider that they may not be releasing the footage to fuel the truther movement.
I could consider that, but I don't think that's the case. I suspect they're, I mean, I, like I said, I don't want to speculate. I could say I suspect this, or I could say I suspect that. I honestly don't know. The truth is, I honestly don't know. And if they have footage, then I would suggest that they do release it. But I would suggest the government release a lot of stuff. I would suggest the government not spy on its citizens.
Yes.
You know, that doesn't, that they don't start Operation Prism. I would suggest that the government do and then not do a lot of things. But the government, which is not some monolithic entity, by the way, people always talk about the government. The government is a vast, or to call it an organization is a bit of a misnomer. It's a vast, but a vast thing, we'll say, of competing interests, including even within the intelligence community, the FBI, the CIA, the AFOSI, the NSA. I mean, you can go down all the NRO, you can go down all the alphabet soup agencies just in the U.S. And then there's Mossad and MI5 and MI6 and CSIS in Canada. So then there's all the allied agencies, all of them within the United States and without the United States, competitive with each other. They guard their secrets, which was the real, one of the real lessons out of 9/11 is that the intelligence community in the United States was fractured, that there wasn't a central, as much as you'd like to think there is, there wasn't a central sort of master Dalek figure, you know, sitting there controlling everything. Because then that actually might have made it harder for the terrorists to succeed. Instead, you had all these competing agencies that were withholding information from each other, that maybe this guy considered something important and this guy didn't. And that's the takeaway. The takeaway was a massive failure of the intelligence community. And there's something that's very rarely talked about, 9/11. And that is, I guess there's no other way for me to put it, but a reverse racism, or kind of a, ironically enough, a cultural superiority amongst the truthers. Because the truthers, and you'll hear, there's the Paracast, there's a radio, not a radio, yeah, sure, it's a radio show that I'm extremely critical of on a regular basis, and nobody should ever listen to it. But every now and then I go to the Paracast forums because they amuse me. And there's a guy there who goes by the name of Pixel Smith, and he's a rabid 9/11 truther. He's also a denier of global warming and a whole bunch of other stuff. But on the 9/11 truth thing, he will often throw out lines like, yeah, you know, nine Arab terrorists with box cutters, who knew they were weapons of mass destruction? And within that, there is a sense of cultural superiority, and there is an implied racism that we are the greatest nation on earth, because he's an American. We are the greatest nation on earth. We are invulnerable. We are the mighty empire. Nobody can harm us. They could never, and they wouldn't phrase it like this, but this is what's implied. These towel-wearing, desert-dwelling, subhuman, no-education goofballs from the Middle East with box cutters somehow managed to bring down the symbol of the American empire, which is the tallest buildings in the United States, and totally, and attack the Pentagon and do all that other stuff. Impossible. Couldn't do it. And I go, very possible. You know, a very dedicated group, a small dedicated group of people with a mission, with a goal, with an ideology that spurs them on to take incredible risks, can accomplish incredible things in good and bad ways. That's how the United States was formed. They fought back against an incredibly powerful global empire, starting off with very small groups of Minutemen who the British would have labeled terrorists if the word terrorist was used back then. I think the word they used was traitors. But And eventually they built up a movement that the British decided was worth more trouble than it's worth. And you have to view the 9/11 attacks within that context. This is not a one-off. This was part of a movement that had been ongoing. The bombing of the USS Cole, you can trace it all the way back to the 1980s. You can also see it in terms of the attacks against the Soviets when they were occupying Afghanistan. This wasn't a one-off. This is part of a continuum of trying to remove all Western influence from the Middle East. And Israel factors into it and other things. So these are highly motivated, highly dedicated individuals who were a little more sophisticated than guys like Pixelsmith like to give them credit for. They were educated, they were trained, and again, like I said, very highly motivated. And they pulled off something. Yes, they did pull off this. They'll never be able to do it again. These kind of things are one-way missions in more ways than one. They're one-way missions, obviously, for these guys because they're all dead. But it's also a one-way mission in terms of actually being able to do it. Because once you do it, you'll probably never be able to use that trick again because now they're wise to you. But until you do it, it hasn't been done before. Most people would probably think nobody would be foolish enough to try, that our security systems are sufficient, that we can't possibly... So Pixelsmith's thinking... The thinking of the truthers along those lines is, ironically enough, the exact thinking that led to the attacks being successful in the first place. A hubris, a belief that you are invulnerable, that these guys can never possibly pierce us with these kind of low-tech weapons or these crazy strategies. And I would say if you read crack any history book, you will see that this kind of group, these kind of people can be very, very successful at using this kind of warfare, which is what we're talking about, these kind of tactics, terrorist tactics, if you want to call them that, fighting back against a power that has far superior weaponry and resources. Because frankly, the Irish did it. You can see it in German history, Italian history, Spanish history. I can go down the list. All these guys did was they brought it into the modern age and really were more successful on a bigger scale than these other groups. But I remember the IRA. I was living in Scotland at the time of the Enniskillen bombing in 1987, which was a bombing that took place on Remembrance Day. It was Remembrance Day, November 11th. And I think a dozen people or whatever were killed at this Remembrance Day ceremony. And terrorists have been conducting, I mean, there was no more secure place on the planet. Maybe there was, but this would have been in your top 10. Northern Ireland, pretty darn secure. Locked down. And yet the IRA consistently was able to pull off terrorist attacks using low-grade weaponry, tactics, strategies that the British would never use because they didn't have to. They had tanks and all that other sort of stuff. So, and you can see it in Vietnam, the same kind of question. How did these Vietnamese beat the world's greatest military? Well, the answer is eventually they just wear you down. And if you viewed the 9/11 attack within that perspective, it's part of a long-term effort by these fundamentalist Islamic groups that have more support amongst moderate Islamic people than you would think, largely because these people live in countries that we've occupied and they want us out. So this is part of a long-term effort to get us out, to just wear us down, to bring the fight back to our shores and eventually make it so that we do what the British did in 1783 in the United States. It's more trouble than it's worth. We're coming home. And, you know, actually, if you look at the way things have worked out, they lured us in, they suckered us in to going into Iraq and Afghanistan when we didn't have to, and now we're stuck there. And we've lost thousands upon thousands of our own troops, billions upon billions of dollars from our treasury, we've wrecked our economies, and that can all be traced back to 9/11. And so if I'm them, I go, that's a win for us. And we're tired of it now. Right? Because now you see we want to drop some bombs on Syria. People don't want to do that. People are tired of all these wars. They're tired of the Middle East. They want us to come home. Obama got elected on the promise of coming home. And that is the legacy of 9/11. That is the ultimate thing that they wanted to accomplish. Get us out, mostly you, because I'm Canadian, so get you guys out, so that they can do whatever they want in their own countries. And it's probably not going to be good. And it would be something that we maybe wouldn't like, but they want the ability to do that. So that's what 9/11 was really about. It's part of a geopolitical global movement that has been going on for a long time and is still going on and will continue to go on.
I think a lot of the countries over there also view us as the bad guys. We're the ones doing drone strikes and killing innocent women and children, and for some reason it's okay when we do it.
Absolutely, sure. I would tell you that if I was living, if I had been born, say, in, I don't know, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, in 1980, so that I would have been 21 when 2001 rolled around, I would like to think there's a reasonably good chance that I would have been what we call a terrorist, what they would view as a freedom fighter. Now, I'm not saying they're right. I'm not saying that flying planes into the World Trade Centers and killing thousands of people is right. But on the other hand, I can understand where they're coming from, because in our own history, we've done the same things. If you look at the history of the American Revolution, the patriots or the revolutionaries were guilty on a smaller scale, because we were just dealing with smaller scale back then, of atrocities against Tories, that is, American colonists who stayed loyal to the British, against the British themselves, and the British committed atrocities against them. But that's what happens. So these people, Noam Chomsky is absolutely right. They look at us, and again, by us, I mean you, but Canada is an ally and we're part of it. All of the West is part of it. They look at us as an occupying power that exploits them economically, keeps the majority of their people mired in poverty. We prop up these dictatorial regimes of sheiks and military strongmen that keep their people in line so that we can pull out money, all the money we can gouge out of their countries. We put military bases on their land, often in areas that they consider sacred and holy. I would just say, look, if this happened to us, the only way to kind of really understand it is if Martians showed up tomorrow, or Zeta Reticulans, and did the exact same thing to the United States, using overwhelming technological advantage, basically turn the United States into Saudi Arabia or Iraq, you know, a country that was controlled. And we've overthrown the regimes, too. You know, look up coup, Iraq, British, American. Use those four words in a Google search, or Iran. And you'll find out all sorts of interesting things about how we've destabilized the regimes, elected regimes there. So, you know, if the Zeta Reticulans came down and did that to the United States, what do you think Americans would do? How would they react? Well, some of them would sign with the aliens. Sure, you'd sell out. You'd become part of the ruling elite. But a lot of people would be pretty, you know, angry under the surface. And some of them, perhaps through even religious motivations, would be, you know, these are the Antichrist demons from space. We have to fight back in the name of God. I can see evangelical pastors saying stuff like that. Some of them might actually strap bombs on their chests or figure out ways to hijack a spacecraft and fly it into the mothership or something like that.
Right.
And if you, you know, even within our own fiction, you can see that kind of thing happening. Go look at V, the original series, not the remake, where there would be terrorist attacks being what, you know, we would call terrorist attacks being committed by American patriots, or Terran, human patriots, against the lizard people. So you kind of have to put yourself in their shoes without excusing acts of violence against civilian targets. But we shouldn't excuse acts of violence against civilian targets when we commit them either. So
exactly.
It's a more complex story, and the lessons that we should be taking out of 9/11 are not the lessons that we took out of 9/11. The lesson, the general narrative out of it was, we need to militarize, we need to curtail our own civil rights, we need to invade these countries. That's what we got. What we should have gotten was a moment where we would say, look, we abhor the actions of these terrorists. If they were still alive, we would hunt them down and put them to trial. However, having said that, we need to take a moment and think, what would drive people to do this? And we can't just say because they're all crazy. We need to think about what we're doing and maybe find a better way of coexisting with different cultures and different countries, and look at our own policies and how we're exploiting them. And instead, what we did is we just went in, we kind of said, you know what, we're going all in. You're all in, we're all in. And look where we are.
Yeah, and I think that's a perfect way of saying it, too. And I mean, we are seeing the same run-up to Syria that we were seeing with places like Iraq.
Yeah. Well, it all comes back to Iran, which is the dominant power in the region, dominant regional power, that is not us. And it comes back to the blank. You can be critical of Israeli foreign policy without being anti-Semitic. You can also be anti-Semitic and use criticism of Israeli foreign policy as a shield for your anti-Semitism. So sometimes it's a fine line for some people to understand. I am supportive of Israel, and I'm supportive of the people of Israel, but I'm also critical of their policies in many instances. And I am critical of the blank check that the American government has for decades given Israel in terms of dealing with the Middle East. And there is a deal to be had, and the Palestinians were their own worst enemy by rebuffing deals. But the United States, if they really wanted to make some traction there, would say, we need to get the Israelis, the Palestinians, and the Arab states in the same room together and say, look, here's the deal. Here's the deal on the table. No one's going to be completely happy with it, but this is, you have to take this deal. Because if you don't, we're out. Israel, you're on your own. Good luck with that. Oh, and by the way, Arab states, you're on your own because Israel has nukes. So good luck invading them because the Israelis are just crazy enough to fire the nukes off at you. So, but we wash our hands of it unless you take this deal. And part of the deal is we give a security guarantee to the state of Israel. Any of you attack Israel, that will be considered an attack on the United States of America, and we will respond in kind. So we will protect Israel. And Israel would be like, awesome, dude. And then the Americans should need to turn to the Israelis and go, here's the thing. You know, you can't keep building settlements. You can't keep the Palestinian people in the equivalent of apartheid concentration camps. Here's the things you can't do. You have to make peace with your neighbors. You have to accept this deal. And you have to get on with life. And that's the deal that the Americans need to broker and that they've never been able to pull off for various reasons. But everybody needs to be made to understand that you have to have that deal. And that is the core of the problem in the Middle East, is the ongoing presence of Israel that not everybody there in the Arab side has accepted, but also the Israelis' own actions toward the Palestinians, which inflames sentiment on the street against both Israel and its ally, the United States, and which also, by the way, serves the interests of the autocracies in the Arab countries, because they've been horrible to the Palestinians. They have a significant amount of blame for the plight of the Palestinians lies with other Arab leaders, and the Palestinians' own leaders. And so it's a complex problem. It's kind of like the Gordian knot, but a smart diplomat and a president willing to use to really seek peace in the Middle East, I think, could pull it off. And yet we really haven't seen one do that. Instead, they're just dropping bombs.
And the question is, do we really want peace in the Middle East?
Well, yeah, that's a very good question, isn't it? Because if you had peace in the Middle East, what would that look like? What would that mean? What kind of governments would we deal with? Let's assume that all of the Middle East suddenly turned into democracies, which is what we say we want, right? So we want Israel's a democracy. Let's say the Palestinians have a democracy. We just generally don't respect the results. Let's say all these countries turn into democracies overnight. Well, what happens then when most of them maybe vote in socialist governments or governments that, while they're not unfriendly to the United States, they're not going to declare war on the United States, but economically, maybe they like dealing with China better. Maybe that's a better deal. Maybe all of a sudden, the economic interests of the United States and the other Western powers in terms of selling arms, in terms of taking oil out of the Middle East, these elected democratic governments, the will of the people in those countries doesn't jibe with what we want. Well, there was another 9/11 anniversary. 40 years ago, in 1973, on 9/11, Salvador Allende was overthrown in Chile by Augusto Pinochet and other military leaders. He was an elected, democratically elected socialist leader who was leading the country of Chile away from the United States and towards more of a sort of third world, other, you know, somewhere in the middle kind of not Soviet allegiance, but also not in the American camp. We're going to follow our own third path of independence, and which means we might do deals with the Soviets and we might do deals with you too. We might nationalize your economic interests here for the benefit of the Chilean people, and on and on and on. Well, what happened? He didn't last very long. An American-sponsored and approved coup, military coup, overthrew him and democracy was thrown out. And that's just one. So that's the other 9/11 that we should have remembered on 9/11 this year, because that's the United States interfering in the sovereign affairs of another country. And you might be able to justify that if it's a brutal dictatorship that's killing all of its own people, although we, generally speaking, allow most of those to continue when there are friends.
Sure.
Look up the country Equatorial Guinea, folks, in Africa, where we have the United States has, hey, he's our friend. There's a picture of Obama and his wife standing next to the president of Equatorial Guinea and his wife. And this guy is a brutal dictator. He's a brutal military dictator. But hey, he's our brutal military dictator. But even if you could justify the overthrow of those kind of people, how do you justify the overthrow of a democratically elected government that maybe is taking a policy that is contrary to what you would wish they would do? And so that's what you might face in the Middle East, governments that would choose to do things that you might not like. Well, you can either, you've got two choices. You can either accept that that might happen and deal with it, treat them fairly, try and give them the best deal. Isn't that what capitalism is all about? Hey, right. We'll take our chances in competition. That's the free market. We love the free market. The truth is the Americans don't love the free market. The Americans love the American market, which is like the Ferengi, to go out and exploit people as much as you can for your own self-interest. And the people at home, the lifestyle that we live, and the Canada and all the Western powers benefit from this. So we're, in our own way, as guilty as anyone else, even though Canadians don't like to admit that.
Well, it's been pointed out, too, that we're not in a free market, because if we were in a free market, those banks that failed would have failed.
Right. Right. Well, yeah, you've got three choices. Either the banks fail. That's one choice. That's the true free market choice. And that would be bad. A lot of bad stuff would have come out of that. Maybe it would have been a better option or a worse option than what happened. Who knows? We couldn't say, because it didn't happen. But that's one option. That's the pure free market option that if you're a Republican, you should have, and even these days, most Democrats go, yes, that's the American way. If you can't make it, fail and start again, whatever. The middle option is the option they chose, which is we'll bail you out with government money, but you get to keep your banks and you get to keep your investment houses. So it's kind of like free money. I wish they'd do that for me. I mean, my company's had trouble every now and then. It's like, hey, I could use a check. How come I don't get that check? But I don't. So that's the middle option. The other option, of course, is the one that I would favor, what the American government should have done and what it would never do, because people bring up the word socialism and Americans have been inculcated to believe that socialism is a dirty word, even though it's not. They should have nationalized the banks. They should have said, clearly, we can't let you fail because that would wreck the economy. But we're not going to reward you by allowing you to keep your banks and your investment companies with no real penalty. None of you are going to jail. You get to keep it. You get to make money because we're going to bail you out with taxpayer dollars, the same taxpayers who you've just wrecked their economy. No, here's what we're going to do. We're taking the banks from you. It's now owned by the people. And what we do with it after that, who knows? Maybe we'll privatize them down the road, because that has happened in countries that have nationalized industries. Eventually, they reprivatize them. But it's not going to be you owning them. We're not going to give you money to cover up your mistake for destroying the financial system. That's done. We're going to reboot. It's like a computer. The computer doesn't work, so we're going to reboot it. And you're not part of that. And that's called nationalization. And there's nothing wrong with it. And that's what they should have done. But they didn't, because they muddled through and said, well, we're going to call it the free market, but we're going to bail them out. But so who pays for that? Well, the citizens pay, not the rich ones, but the good, solid, lower and middle class working citizens who pay their taxes and are honest. Those are the people paying for it, even though the people benefiting from it are the people that started all these wars, that reap all these profits. I mean, I think you can see where we're both going, Soraya, in the same direction. I think we're both agreeing here that this is not a sustainable sort of model of how you should run a country.
It might as well be a company in some respects.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's a corporate. I don't know what's a corporate fascistocracy. Maybe I've just invented a word, but there's a really good editorial piece that I emailed you today.
Yes.
By a former foreign affairs writer for the New York Times. Let me just call it up here in a second.
It was called The Dead Rhetoric of War.
Right, by Chris Hedges.
Yeah.
And, I could read the whole thing. I would suggest that people, it's at truthdig.com. And if you go to truthdig.com and Google The Dead Rhetoric of War, Chris Hedges, you'll find it. And it's a wonderful 3 or 4 paragraph, although they're very long paragraphs, essay on everything that's gone wrong since 9/11 in the United States. All the mistakes that have been made, all the lies that have been told, and how, well, here's his final line in the paragraph that I posted. There's another paragraph after this, but this is the one that I like the most. War is made of a few very rich, as it always does, as our schools, libraries, and firehouses are closed in the name of fiscal austerity. Basic social service programs for children and the elderly are shut down. Cities such as Detroit declare bankruptcy, and chronic underemployment and unemployment hover at 15%, perhaps 20%. No one knows the truth anymore about America. The vast Potemkin village we've become, the monstrous lie that is America, includes the willful manipulation of financial and official statistics from Wall Street and Washington. Oh. Sorry.
Telephone.
And just as I say that, that's the NSA folks calling and telling me that they're my front door. You're not allowed to be here, people. This is Canada. You can't. That'll be CSIS at my front door. But read the folks. Read the Hedges thing. Read and listen to Noam Chomsky and all the other voices in the progressive. What's left of the progressive left that are talking, because it, and some of them are also on the libertarian right. I think most libertarians are crazy, but there are some voices on the libertarian right that do make good points every now and then. And so it's this weird world where you have people on the libertarian right and on the far progressive left who generally are agreeing about what America is becoming, and everybody else is being sucked into this imperial core. And if you look at history, you can see this kind of thing happening before. And I would point you to the history, the death of the Republic and the rise of the Roman Empire, because we're kind of seeing, and it's not an exact comparison. And obviously 2,000 years later, it's a different world. But the mechanism of what's happening is eerily similar.
Yeah. And to be honest, I probably fall more into the libertarian camp, but the people I agree with are either the libertarians or the progressive left. And it's not, you know, I'm not one of these people who strictly puts myself in one category or another.
No, neither am I. I mean, yeah, I agree with you. There are points that libertarians, I don't like labels, period. So having just labeled two groups of people, if somebody
whoever has the best idea is the one I agree with as far as I'm concerned, anyway.
I agree. I think we should all be like that. And that's the problem, is that you see so many people, it's almost like cheering for sports teams. So
yeah,
you see, I am a Boston Red Sox fan. I can only cheer for the Boston Red Sox. It has to be the Boston Red Sox. Well, I am. That wasn't me talking. That's the kind of thing. So if you are a New York Yankee or a Los Angeles Dodger, I hate you. I hate your team. I hate your city. I hate your fans. I hate everything about you. I never want to visit your city. Boo. I can cheer for the Boston Red Sox and at the same time respect the New York Yankees. Doesn't mean I have to like them as a team, but I can respect them. And I can actually look at players like Mariano Rivera and Derek Jeter and say, you guys are Hall of Famers. Gosh, I wish we had you on our team. I like the way you play. And that's kind of the political equivalent of saying, you know what? I don't agree with the general overarching political philosophy of the New York Yankees. But you know what? You got some good ideas. There are things within your party, within this vast kind of, and that's what a political party is, a vast conglomeration of competing interests and ideologies and positions. And that's, I actually think, a good thing, that people come together and reach some sort of consensus. Within that, I can say, look, I like your Derek Jeter idea, I like your Joe Girardi idea, and I like your Mariano Rivera idea. I don't like the rest of them. But I wish we had those ideas. We should take them. We should try and buy them, to use the baseball metaphor. And the Yankees should be able to say, we like your Dustin Pedroia idea. And we like, you know, your pick a guy. We like your, oh, wait, he's having a bad season. I was going to say Roy Halladay from the Phillies, but, you know, some sort of pitcher. We like that guy from that team. And that's how you take the best player, and what you wind up with is an all-star team. You get the best players. And isn't that what we want? Shouldn't
exactly.
The apotheosis of political discourse should be an all-star team of ideas, wherever they come from. And if it comes from the Republicans and you're a Democrat, then you should go, you know what, embrace it. Great idea. If you're a Republican and it comes from the Democrats and it's going to make lives better for people on the ground, then embrace it. And that would be a truly independent position. And you can be an independent Democrat, you could be an independent Republican, you could be an independent progressive or an independent libertarian, whatever you want to call yourself. But it should just be about getting that all-star team of great ideas. And that is not what it's about. It has become impossible, especially in the United States, but even in Canada, to have, because it is, we demonize not just the other party, but we demonize anyone who follows them, and then we demonize their ideas too. And here's a good example. In Canada, we have a conservative government. I don't like them. I don't like the vast majority of their policies, but they're not always wrong. Some of the policies that come out of our conservative government are actually useful and good. and have been successful. Just because I might be on the progressive left, I should never be afraid to say, you know what, that's actually a good idea. We can get behind that. We can work with you on that. And by the way, you should maybe, the conservatives should be willing to say every now and then, people on the left have a good idea. And then you get that all-star, and there will always be disagreements in places where you differ, and that's fine. But if you can, if you don't have the ability to get that all-star team of ideas, you're lost from the very beginning. And you wind up with a society like the one we have now, where nothing really ever gets done.
Nothing gets done, and people spend all their time fighting to support, blindly support their position.
Yes. Like me. No, I don't. Only in ufology do I fight to blindly support my position.
You're a very level-headed person when you approach things, and that's what I like about you.
Yeah, well, you know, even on the 9/11 truther thing, because I sort of made fun of them, and I was a little, I don't apologize for that. But, you know, I was kind of cranky and whatever, and it does make me a little cranky. But at the end of the day, you know, we still had a beer with these guys, going back to the 2007 thing. And we didn't yell at each other. And even though I said, look, if you haven't read the 9/11 Commission report, we can't really have a conversation because you don't know what you're talking about. And they might have said the same thing to us because I think they called us government shills. But then it was like, well, okay, we can all agree on a Sam Adams, right? Or whatever we were drinking. And you can still be friendly about it.
But I also suspect if something came out that proved that the government had some foreknowledge or some hand in the attack that proved it, not a theory, like something slipped out that proved it, you would be willing to accept that.
Sure. You show me, I say the same thing about Roswell, show me the alien spacecraft or the bodies or whatever, or conclusive evidence, indisputably conclusive evidence, beyond a reasonable doubt that this happened, whatever this is. And I will absolutely get behind that. I just believe with 9/11 that there is indisputable conclusive evidence that shows what happened. And it's the so-called official narrative. So if somebody, but I am always, as any reasonable person should be, open to persuasion, but I haven't seen anything from the 9/11 truther camp that would persuade me that my conclusion is wrong. So, but if they can come up with it, sure. If they can come up with a guy, credible witnesses who walked forward and said, yep, we wired the buildings, we blew them up, and we remote controlled the planes and blah, blah, blah. And we did all this. We admit it. We are willing to be tried and convicted in a court of law, but we want to confess. I go, well, that's interesting. Or if you have video footage, indisputable video footage of this kind of thing happening, fine. But you don't. So
Of an actual indisputable missile hitting the Pentagon.
Sure. Show me that. And that would be very interesting. As my friend Nick would say, interesting if true. So,
yes.
Which is one of his sayings. So, yeah. And the same thing is true of Roswell. The same thing is true of anything. Anything that is sort of a conspiracy or whatever you want to call it. Show me the evidence. Convince me. If you can't convince me, well, that's on you, I think, not on me.
With Roswell, I think the only thing that could ever happen to settle it would be the government coming out saying, yes, an alien craft crashed. Here it is. You know, come up, touch it, feel it, et cetera, et cetera. Because anything less than that, you can't prove a negative.
No.
You know, you can't prove something that an alien craft didn't crash. I think we have a number of things that could explain what actually happened that day, but the people who really believe that it's an alien craft are never going to go for that.
Well, and you don't have to either. That when I was talking to Kevin Randall, that was my whole point. The United States government is under no obligation to answer all of the questions raised, and by questions, most of them I think are crazy questions, by the so-called Roswell Brigade of ET believers. The United States government put out an explanation in the 1990s, the Project Mogul. I don't even think they had to do that. Because in order for the government or anybody, even a private citizen in a debate or anything, to have to put out an answer, they first have to be asked a good question. They have to be shown proof. And the proof just didn't exist for Roswell. Yes, there were these witnesses, but as we've seen, they've almost all collapsed. Glenn Dennis was a liar. I mean, I can go down the list. Even as Kevin admitted, you know, Frank Kaufman was one of their key witnesses, liar. Gerald Anderson was one of Stan Friedman's key witnesses, liar. Glenn Dennis, key witness, the only real witness to the so-called alien body recovery, liar. And you just keep going down and down, and sooner or later, all these witnesses that they were saying, look at this case we've built. Well, it was a case built on a house of cards. and it fell apart. So the government was under no obligation to offer any explanation because they hadn't made their case on the other side. Now, I think the government did offer an explanation in good faith. Project Mogul and later the Crash Test Dummies, which was an addendum where they tried to explain away the story of the alien bodies that has no evidence for it. At least there's evidence something clearly did crash in the New Mexico right. desert.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So fine. But there's no evidence whatsoever of bodies. There just isn't, because all the witnesses that talked about it have been, even by Roswell researchers, kind of discredited. So what the government was doing was they're going, we don't know. We have no idea. I can picture them sitting in the Air Force going, we don't know, but we've got these crazy people out here talking about dead alien bodies. We didn't address that in the Mogul thing. So let somebody come up with an answer. And they did. And it was a crazy answer, time compression and crash test dummies and all that. And yeah, it made them look stupid and it made them look like they were really lying. But if you were going to lie, you'd come up with something better than that. But that was them making a good faith effort to try and answer a question that didn't have to be answered. So
I always liked John Keel's explanation. I thought he kind of covered all the salient points with the Fugo balloon.
Yeah, maybe. Although I buy Mogul. I know that a lot of the Roswellians sort of say, oh, this and this and this and this, and they get dragged down into these. Like, this is what happens in conspiracies with conspiracy theorists. They'll write thousands upon thousands of words when a sentence would do, you know, but they just keep writing. It's this obsessive compulsive behavior on many of, not all, but a lot of their parts in the subculture. And it's kind of weird, but you can see that if you go to Kevin Randall's blog. There's a guy named David Rudiak, and he spews out thousands upon thousands of words about why it couldn't have been Mogul, but he never actually says why it couldn't have been Mogul. So, but it sounds impressive if you don't know what you're talking about and you read it. And if you're one of these guys who believes that the number of words generated is indicative of the quality of the argument. But as my dad, and it never really stuck with me, but as my dad, obviously, but as my dad always told me and still tells me, brevity, son, is the source of wit. Or to paraphrase Michael Donovan's Keep It Simple, Stupid, you could also say Keep It Short, Stupid. Hmm. Yeah. And I don't take my own advice. I'm terrible. So,
so to finish this up, let me get your impression on this to contrast. Mm-hmm. What do you think happened with JFK?
Well, he was shot. No,
right. And I mean, do you believe there was a conspiracy involved there?
Okay, well, that's a much more interesting one. See, that's a whole other show. Because while I am convinced beyond any reasonable doubt that 9/11 is what the official narrative says it was, JFK, different story. I'm not convinced that it was a conspiracy, a government conspiracy or a mafia conspiracy or anything else to kill JFK. But I am not completely convinced that the narrative of the lone gunman shooter, Lee Harvey Oswald, is accurate as well. And so I have an open mind on the whole JFK thing. I'm not sure we know the truth yet. And JFK is interesting because let's contrast that with 9/11. In order to pull off 9/11, you would have needed hundreds or thousands of people to be involved in the conspiracy. The same thing is true of Roswell. Eventually, you would have needed hundreds or thousands of people to be in on that conspiracy. With JFK, assuming there is a conspiracy, you don't. You would have needed, I don't know, maybe a dozen, a few shooters, a couple of guys to set the shooters up. Pulling off an assassination, look at the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand that started the First World War by the Black Hand, the Serbian nationalist terrorist group. Serbian. Let's just call it Balkan. The Balkan terrorist group, the Black Hand, Gavrilo Princip. There were two assassins. He was the successful one. I actually sat in the jail cell that the Austrians put him in. He wasn't executed. Weird historical side note. When I was visiting Terezin, which is was a concentration town that turned into a concentration camp by the Nazis. Prior to that, it was a prison run by the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And so one of the cells there is actually the cell that Gavrilo Princip wound up in and spent the First War. He died, I think, shortly after the First World War of illness that he contracted in the prison, but he wasn't executed for killing Archduke Ferdinand and starting the First World War, which I always found interesting. I never really knew what happened to him until I went to Terezin and I sat, there's a picture of me sitting in his cell. It was a pretty uncomfortable cell, I have to say. So, but that was a very small conspiracy. Very few people knew about it and they pulled it off because that kind of thing, those are the conspiracies that you can get away with. And JFK would have been an equally relatively small group of people pulling it off and knowing about it and makes it much easier to pull off, much easier to cover up. So I don't think, I mean, I've been to Dallas for what this was worth. I've stood up in this, in the building on the floor, right? They have a, you can't stand where Lee Harvey Oswald stood, but because it's glassed off, but you can stand right next to it. So you can imagine, you can look out the window, you can see how the, it's a very small constrained space. It looks much bigger on television. If you watch it on television, it looks like a much bigger space. In person, that particular area is really small. And you can see where the grassy knoll is, and you can see all these different places. And you can see how what Kennedy was driving into was basically a crossfire. If you were going to set up that kind of thing, that's where you would have done it. And was Lee Harvey Oswald a patsy? That's a much longer conversation. But yeah, my short answer is, no, I don't believe it was a conspiracy, or I'm not convinced it was. But no, I'm not completely convinced that it was just Lee Harvey Oswald either. I still think that one's an open case, and we don't know. And I'm not sure that we'll ever know.
What did you think of Howard Hunt's deathbed confessions?
I'm not a big fan of deathbed confessions, because people can say all sorts of things on their deathbed for all sorts of reasons, including being delusional because they're dying. Who knows? So I need, you know, I need more than deathbed confessions or anything like that. I you know, it's very reasonable, sensible people can look at the JFK assassination and disagree, that they can say it was Lee Harvey Oswald. And reasonable, sensible people, rational people on the other side can construct a very good argument for why it was not. The one thing I don't think, you know, I can go down and say, here's things I'm convinced are not the case. I'm convinced that Lyndon Johnson was, if there was a conspiracy, was not part of it. Now, he benefited, I guess, from it because he became president. But there's no evidence that's ever been presented that would show that Lyndon Johnson was part of that conspiracy. Then you're left with, okay, well, who would have committed the conspiracy? Well, the theories range from the mafia to the intelligence agencies to the Cubans, the Soviets, to a combination of all of the above. Who knows? I don't know if we'll ever know. I really, you know, honestly don't know if we'll ever know. And it's made Kennedy into this mythical. He wasn't actually a terribly good president. He did some good things. He did some bad things. And frankly, Lyndon Johnson did far more good things than Kennedy did in terms of the domestic scene in the United States. Now, Lyndon Johnson has to wear the Vietnam War, but it was Kennedy that really got them in there. And you hear people say that Kennedy, I heard crazy Jerome Corsi. In my opinion, he's crazy. So there you go. I'm constitutionally protected. In my opinion, he's crazy. He was on Coast to Coast last night, and I listened to a bit because he was talking about the JFK assassination. I guess he's got a new book out. And he was linking all of this different stuff. Like it was economic interest to get us into Vietnam and this and that and everything in the mafia and it's all involved. And I just thought, well, again, see, you've turned it into an octopus. You've turned it into this vast thing, when in fact it was probably a very small group that, if it did happen, would have had very particular reasons for doing it. The mafia makes sense. You know, they were going after organized crime. Maybe the intelligence agencies would have made sense, because Kennedy had a very
bad relationship with them?
With elements of them, yes.
Yes.
The Cubans would have made sense. And by Cubans, I mean the sort of anti-Castro Cubans, because of the Kennedy's failure in their eyes to follow through on the Bay of Pigs invasion by providing American air and ground and naval support in a way that would have been decisive against the Castro regime. So they thought that he just left these guys there to die, which is what he did, but it wasn't his idea. He inherited that from the Eisenhower administration. And, you know, after that and after the Cuban Missile Crisis, no wonder he was distrustful of the military and the intelligence agencies. So, yeah. The JFK thing I still find interesting, and to me that's still an open case.
All right. Well, I just wanted to get a brief take on that. Well, I thank you for this. This has been really fascinating. I like to get your opinion on things like this. You, like I said, you have a different viewpoint than I do, and I like that. I like getting different angles, different perspectives, and hopefully we can do this on a semi-regular basis.
No, absolutely. I really enjoy talking to you. I'm sorry, I do have a tendency to monopolize the conversation. I ramble on, so I apologize to people who've had to listen to me say in 1,000 words what I probably could have said in 50. But I do enjoy talking about these things, too. I'm glad you asked me, because you know, long before I was looking into UFOs or ghosts or anything like that, what I studied was politics, foreign policy, law, government, and history. So I actually much prefer talking about those things. And if you can mix in a reference to Roswell every now and then, even better. So right. Then it's kind of like the perfect storm of a conversation with me. So thanks very much, Soraya, for asking me to be part of this and asking me hopefully to, you know, be a semi-regular part of it.
Absolutely.
Really enjoyed it.
Where can people find all your stuff? What's your website?
Southern New Mexico. No, wait, that's where they can find the aliens. My website is, my company's website is redstarfilmtv.com. So if you go to radio on that there, you can find my podcasts. You can find the books that my company publishes and is going to be publishing there. And you can also find pretty much all my films, at least all the paranormal related ones, are available to watch free on the website, thanks to our American distributors.
Awesome. All right. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Soraya. Great talking to you. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? To perfection. 5, 8, 3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Whence came this dream that haunts my mind? Behind a curtain, outside of time. Can you hear the knowledge plays, the whirring of the world? Can you hear the knowledge plays, the whirring of the world? Can you hear the the whirring of the world. Come in, come in, we hear you loud and clear. Beginning our conversion of the signal here. 1597 and counting. Can you